newyorktimes.net.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
CNN can now project that Barack Obama will become the President of the United States.
We have come to the end of a long journey.
This is our moment. This is our time.
The Bible calls this day Armageddon.
That doesn't sound too nefarious.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
This election had many firsts.
Your position on abortion tells us a whole lot about you.
Only in America.
You're very perceptive.
God bless America.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta, and we've got 3 hours to talk about the things that matter most. 70 years ago, beginning yesterday and going through today, November 9th and 10th, 1938, were the days that have become known to us as Kristallnacht and often used as a marker for the beginning of the Holocaust. Pope Benedict XVI from Germany said he feels pain for what happened in his homeland when Nazis mobbed thousands of Jewish businesses. About 300 synagogues were destroyed. Pope was 11 years old and at that time. Mitchell Bard has joined us a number of times in discussions in the Middle East. Well, I was delighted to find that he had a book here of oral history regarding 48 hours of Kristallnacht, the two nights, Nights of Destruction, Dawn of the Holocaust. And so Dr. Bard will be with us in just a few minutes to talk over some of the memories that he's collected. Also coming up, today, everybody wants to make a difference. Everybody wants to think that their life has had a positive benefit in the life of others. And Dr. Greg Hushko will be joining me to discuss that in just a little while. I got a few things I want to lay out from various news items that have come up today. Michael Crichton died recently. Miriam Makeba died recently. And Ron Radosh has said that shame on New Yorker magazine and its editor David Remnick, shame on them, he says, for playing a role in the attempt of Bill Ayers and his publisher to resurrect Ayers' book and his reputation. Now, Beacon Press, this is a funny little inside story. Beacon Press have announced that they're releasing an updated version of Ayers' 2001 book, Fugitive Days. This is coming out 2 days from now. Now, this was held up until after the election for deliberate reasons. The original edition had the misfortune of being published on 9/11, and that led to a cancellation of Ayers' book tour and to reams of negative publicity. Radosh is on a mission to let Beacon Press and Bill Ayers know that the American public may have elected Barack Obama president, but they have not changed their mind about the sordid role of Ayers and the Weather Underground in our country's past. It really is a great story, and I look forward to talking with Ron about it coming up a little bit later. So that's happened. Also, Kathy Schiffer joins us live from the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops in Baltimore. And we're also keeping the phone lines available for you. They'll be warm at 1-877-573-7825. But first, to the news headlines with Nick Tom.
Thank you, Alan. A very good afternoon. This is your Ave Maria Radio News. It's Monday, November 10th, the Feast of St. Leo the Great. President-elect Obama and his wife Michelle are at the White House for a visit with the President and First Lady. Obama commented about how the presidential couple looked and was glad to be there.
You both look at some of
Mrs. Bush is showing Mrs. Obama around the private residence of the White House while the President and President-elect talk in the Oval Office. Reversing executive orders is likely to be one of the first actions that Obama takes when he hits the Oval Office. Transition team co-chair John Podesta says Obama is sifting through the orders that President Bush signed over the last 8 years and will move quickly to make some changes once he takes office. Among the items likely to be overturned are limits on embryonic stem cell research in the Mexico City policy, as well as expanding some oil and gas drilling. There have been protests nearly every day since Proposition 8 passed in California, and some say they are going to court in hopes of overturning the ban. Attorney John West filed one of several legal actions against Prop 8 with the state Supreme Court. He says it's the will of the people is not enough.
We have had laws passed which bar sale of real property to minorities. We have had a whole series of laws which bar interracial marriage, things like that. Those are all the will of the people. However, they fundamentally conflict with the basic human rights that are guaranteed in our Constitution.
He says they hope to learn when the cases will be heard in the next few weeks. At least 28 people are dead after a series of attacks in Baghdad. A pair of car bombers targeted a busy shopping area in the central part of the city. A suicide bomber then attacked as rescuers rushed in to help. Several students are said to be among the dead, and police fear the death toll could rise. It's one of the deadliest incidents in the war-torn country in months. And the sour economy has claimed its largest retailer yet. Circuit City has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy just weeks before the holiday shopping season. The electronics giant blames tighter credit terms from vendors, tough competition, and decreased liquidity for the move. The announcement comes just 1 week after the company announced a plan to close more than 150 stores and slash 17% of its workforce. And now your fascinating fact for the day. A duck's quack does not echo, and no one knows why. Reporting for Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Nick Tom.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. November 9th and 10th, 70 years ago, 1938, was what has come to be known as the Night of Broken Glass, Kristallnacht. Nazi orchestrated a pogrom against German and Austrian Jews. Thousands of Jewish businesses, 300 synagogues looted, destroyed. Police and firefighters stood by. The Nazis, in fact, blamed the Jews for Kristallnacht and require them to clean up after the attacks. They impose fines of $400 million on the Jewish community and prevent business owners from collecting insurance. The state at that point confiscates Jewish businesses, expels Jewish children from schools. Dr. Mitchell Baird has collected oral histories of Kristallnacht. It's called 48 Hours of Kristallnacht, Night of Destruction, Dawn of the Holocaust, an oral history. Dr. Bard is author, co-author, or editor of almost 20 books, including the complete history of the Holocaust, and Will Israel Survive? Mitchell, it's good to have you back. Thanks.
Always good to be with you.
Well, excuse me, what do we hear in the oral histories that we don't usually get by reading an encyclopedia description?
Well, it's the personal horror, the personal witness of the terrible things that happened that night. Too often, the Holocaust, as horrible as it comes across, is very dry and statistical. And until you read the actual personal experiences, especially of people who were children at the time, you can't fully comprehend, I think, the magnitude of the horrors of those times.
Now, where did you cull your memories here?
Well, the vast majority of them were already recorded in a variety of different places, most of which never had been published. The largest body of them came from the interviews done by the Shoah Foundation, mm-hmm. where they interviewed 50,000 survivors, and several thousand of them experienced Kristallnacht. And there were several other accounts given in memoirs and other archives in the Holocaust Museum and some other books that have been written. But there were many stories that I don't think have ever been told, and they're really quite dramatic and frightening.
Well, by 1938, there was already concern, wasn't there? I mean, Jewish emigration began as early as 1933, I think.
Well, after Hitler came to power,
yeah.
it didn't take long for the Nazis to begin to impose a variety of restrictive laws on the Jewish community. By the time of Kristallnacht, there was something on the order of 400 different regulations of different types meant to isolate the Jewish people, to intimidate them, to encourage them to leave. But none of that was violent. They were all legislative measures, and it wasn't really until Kristallnacht that there was open attacks against Jewish individuals, their property, their synagogues. And what made it particularly striking was that it was in plain view of everyone, that every German knew and every Austrian knew what was going on. Many of them watched as the stormtroopers rampaged through the streets, through people's homes, and set fire to the synagogues, and some even participated in those activities. So it was the one time in the war when all of the people, the citizens, were a part of what was taking place and couldn't claim to be ignorant and not to know.
What was the pretext for this?
Well, the main pretext, and they didn't really need one, there was a desire to teach the Jews a lesson anyway, but there was a case in which a young Jew who was living in Paris at the time was infuriated after the Nazis in October of 38 had deported his family along with thousands of other Jews of Polish descent to the Polish border and mistreated them there. And that young man, after hearing what happened to his family, went to the German embassy in Paris with the intention of shooting the ambassador and basically shot the first diplomat he saw, which was a third secretary named von Rath. And after that, the Nazis used that as a rallying point for, quote-unquote, expressing the anger of the German people.
Wow.
And Joseph Goebbels, the propaganda minister, was the principal instigator of this.
So are there written orders that we have been able to discover today? Or
yes,
there
were definitely orders given.
Yeah.
Some of the instructions were oral. We don't have, as in the case of the Holocaust in general, a order directly from Hitler. We just know
right.
that he was
right.
there at the time, that he spoke to Goebbels, and that, by all accounts, was aware of what was planned. There are orders in my book, 48 Hours of Kristallnacht, in the appendix. We have the actual orders that went out for some of the attacks. And a lot of it was just a kind of wink and a nod where the Nazi stormtroopers knew that this is what they were supposed to do and no one was going to stop them.
Now, how well integrated into Jewish and Austrian society were Jews? Were there separatist communities, or were they... In other words, if I'm there November 9th, and what am I going to see? Or is it something that it's only taking place in Jewish communities?
No, the Jews were a part of mainstream German
yeah.
and Austrian societies. In fact, they were the elite in many of the societies. They were doctors, lawyers. They were prominent scientists, academics. But through the measures that the Nazis implemented over the years prior to and then immediately after Kristallnacht, they were gradually stripped of their jobs, thrown out of universities. Their properties were Aryanized, that is, taken over by mm-hmm. the state. But up until November 8th, 9th, 10th, many of these people still had prominent positions. They owned major department stores and other businesses, and so they were the neighbors. They
okay.
were the merchants. They were people who everyday Germans and Austrians worked with every day and who frequented their businesses and stores.
Would it have been immediately clear that it was Jewish businesses that were being targeted?
Yeah, there was no question that there were plenty of examples of things being written on the stores, Jews out.
Mm-hmm.
There were towns where the Jews were marched through the streets. With signs on their on their around their necks and chants against them being forced to run through gauntlets. There were stores that were clearly known to be owned by the Jews, and the fact that synagogues everywhere, even in small towns where there were few Jews left, were being set on fire. The holy relics, the Torah scrolls, the prayer books would be set on fire, sometimes thrown out into the streets, and children would stomp on them. It was something that was clearly aimed solely at the Jewish people.
So then, after this event, what is the public rationale for it? What does Hitler say? We can't contain the wrath of the German people.
That was basically the line of the government.
Yeah.
That was the propaganda line. This was the popular anger of the people. We can't stop this. And the reality was that very few Germans were prepared to stand up and to protest or to protect Jews. In 48 Hours of Kristallnacht, I do have a chapter just talking about some of the instances where people did protect Jews and did stand up, but with the exception of a couple of church leaders, the church was silent. Other German institutions were silent. You had heroic gestures by people like the boxing champion Max Schmeling, who hit some Jews in his home for several days. So those were the exception, unfortunately. The vast majority of the people saw what the German state was capable of and how it was able to intimidate those who stood up against it. But again, the people who showed courage and had the moral backbone to take some steps, in some cases, made a difference. There was a German policeman, for example, who told his wife he was going out to prevent a terrible crime from being committed, and he took his gun and stood in front of the synagogue in his town, basically warded off the mobs from and prevented them from destroying that synagogue.
Wow. So resistance was not impossible.
It wasn't impossible, but it was very rare.
Yeah.
And this was the case throughout the period of the Nazis, that we know that even during the Holocaust there were cases where people refused to follow orders to kill Jews and nothing happened to them. But there was always this perception that that was not something that they could do.
Let's start with children, or parents and children. How did parents speak to their children on November 11th or November 10th?
Well, there was not a lot they could say to them. In some cases, there was no father or brother or uncle to speak to them because 30,000 men were arrested and sent to concentration camps. Many of the children and the wives didn't know where their loved ones were taken, and some didn't return for several weeks or months. They often had to be ransomed to get out of the camps. There was not a lot you could tell a child who would watch as their house was ransacked, all of their possessions thrown out the window, their parents thrown down the stairs and beaten. It was something that was incomprehensible to a child.
The arrests, there were many arrests made over those 2 days?
That's right. About 30,000 men were sent to concentration camps. Others were arrested and released before being sent to a camp.
And what was the pretense there? I mean, I understand the racial hatred, but I'm saying usually there's the government tries to come up with some kind of reason why these particular people were arrested on this particular night.
Well, they didn't explain it to anyone, but the reason primarily was twofold. One was to try to scare the Jews and encourage them to leave. At this point, the camps were not designed as extermination centers. There were a number of people who died, and they were horrible places, but the main intent of the Nazis at that time was to encourage Jews to leave Germany and Austria. The other purpose was basically to steal their possessions, where They would either outright take the businesses and property that belonged to the Jews they arrested, or they would force the Jews to sell at bargain basement prices to them, or otherwise ransom their possessions.
Hmm. Mitchell, can you hang on for a little while?
Sure, thanks.
My guest, Dr. Mitchell Bard, 48 Hours of Kristallnacht, Night of Destruction, Dawn of the Holocaust, and Oral History. You're welcome to join us at 1-877-573-7825.
The Ave Maria Communications Guild invites you to activate your faith. All ladies are invited to Heart to Heart Catholic Women's Apostolate Thursday, November 13th at Domino's Farms in Ann Arbor. This month's speaker is WDEO favorite sister Ann Shields, discussing God's plan for our lives. For more information, call 734-930-7497 or visit hearttoheartcwa.com. Bring the whole family to the annual Prayer Vigil for Life, Saturday, November 15th, beginning at Assumption Grotto Church in Detroit. This morning pilgrimage begins with Mass and then processes on foot to two area abortion mills for peaceful protest. For further details, call 313-530-4539. You can find many more events at our website, AveMariaRadio.net. To become a member of the Guild, call 877-288-1077. Catholic Radio, it's yours to keep and to grow.
Looking for an exciting career? RH Publishing is currently launching 5 new local directories and is looking for sales leaders. If you are an experienced print media account executive, this sales position can be a perfect fit. This exciting opportunity, selling display ads in niche market yellow page directories, offers a base salary, plus rewarding commissions, benefits, and incentives throughout the year. A minimum of 1 year advertising sales experience is required. Territories include Wayne, Oakland, Macomb, Washtenaw, and Livingston counties. You must be passionate for sales, a good communicator and team player, self-motivated, enthusiastic, and seeking a full-time position. Positions are limited. Call Kurt today at 1-888-503-8500. That's 1-888-503-8500.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Dr. Mitchell Bard, 48 Hours of Kristallnacht, Night of Destruction, Dawn of the Holocaust, and Oral History. How widespread was the news of Kristallnacht? In other words, you know, today it'd be CNN would be reporting it. Everybody would see it. Did people believe these were local incidents, or were they aware that this was, a nationwide effort?
This was something that was well known inside and outside of the Third Reich. Inside, the Nazis made no secret. They published in their party papers exactly what had happened, although with their own spin on it. But the international press also published what had happened, unlike what you sometimes read about during the Holocaust, that the world didn't know or that the press didn't publish it. This was on the front page of world newspapers.
Okay.
The New York Times had a front page story. The British press all had prominent coverage. Over 1,000 editorials were written criticizing the Nazis. So there was no secret about what had happened. In fact, polls were taken where 94% of Americans said they disapproved of the Nazi treatment of Jews.
Did the persecution of the Jews ever reach this level of public awareness again until after the war?
Probably this was the height of it until much later. That after one of the lessons of what happened from all of the publicity was that the Nazis learned that they should hide what they were doing.
Yeah.
And that was part of the reason for the more secretive way that they carried out the final solution. But for me, one of the most shocking and horrifying aspects of the whole story is the failure of the world to react after it learned what happened. That is, once they saw what Hitler was capable of doing, their unwillingness to act was, I think, what ultimately allowed Hitler to conclude no one would stop him later.
Yeah.
And there was a lot that could have been done without going to war against the Germans, that simply by opening the gates to immigrants, they could have saved tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, especially children. The U.S. Senate was prepared to pass legislation to allow 20,000 Jewish children into the United States. Great Britain, Belgium, Holland took about 10,000 Jewish children, but the United States ended up rejecting that legislation.
It's a very ugly, that's a very ugly moment in American history.
It was, and I think President Roosevelt deserves a lot of the blame, but he was reflecting the popular will.
Yeah.
I said a moment ago, 94% condemned Nazi treatment of Jews, but 72% of the public opposed letting large numbers into the United States, and about two-thirds opposed that legislation to bring children in on an emergency basis.
Yeah.
And there were a variety of reasons. One was we were just coming out of the Great Depression. There was a lot of concern about letting immigrants into the country and how that would impact the economic recovery. There was a certain degree of xenophobia. There was a significant amount of anti-Semitism at the time. And in the case of the legislation specifically, this the argument that would also be used by the State Department later was we don't want to treat Jews differently from the rest. We don't want to single them out as special. They were afraid that if they let children in, that eventually parents would want to come in too. They had a variety of different excuses, and the end result was it condemned hundreds of thousands of people to death.
How did the world, after there's a huge event like this, the world is aware of it, editorials are written, there are photographs. How does an event like this get off the radar? In other words, you would say to yourself, if Hitler's willing and capable of doing this, you know, in full view of the world, obviously he has malicious designs for the future of this people.
Oh, it's even worse, Al, because he explicitly says in January 39 that he basically plans to exterminate the Jewish people. In his major speech to celebrate his the anniversary of coming to power in 33 or 32, he gives a speech before the Reichstag to say that he's prepared to destroy the Jewish people. And his foreign minister said at the time that this was the beginning of the solution to the Jewish problem. So there was really little doubt about what Hitler intended, but people weren't willing to believe even after they saw it with their own eyes.
Was it an imaginative problem? I mean, I'm far removed from it myself. I'm on this side of the event, but at the same time, I think to myself, you know, when somebody, I mean, today we're fairly sensitized, I think, when we hear words that sound genocidal, there's some kind of action taken, at least in Europe and North America.
Well, I'm not sure that we have learned. We're being tested at this very moment by the president of Iran. A lot of people don't like the notion of comparing him to Hitler, but he is using the same kind of terminology threatening
true.
To destroy the Jewish people, to destroy Israel. And the question before the world now is, are we going to do anything about it?
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to allow him to obtain a nuclear weapon that will allow him to carry out his threat?
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people who want to dismiss it as just rhetoric.
Well, actually, I mean,
That's the lesson we, a lot of us take, and I certainly take from history of World War II.
And of course, if Iran was filled with Jews, we'd be more concerned, though. But the question question I have related to this, though, is the continued publication of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, the extraordinary anti-Semitism, which is not just a kind of what in America you would call kind of a redneck phenomenon. I mean, anti-Semitism runs thick at prestigious universities in the Middle East.
Well, the Protocols is a bestseller in the Middle East.
Yeah. So
you have someone like the president of Iran, again, who denies that the Holocaust took place. You have him expressing Elders of Zion-type views. And it's a very widespread phenomenon in the Middle East that I think has shaped whole generations of Arab and Muslim views towards Jews.
See, that now my first thought is, yeah, that's right. But it seems very far away. It's not European. If you know what I'm saying, it just seems far away. Did Americans feel the same kind of distance from Germans that I might feel from Egyptians?
Well, I think there's certainly much closer affinity between Americans and other Western societies than perhaps between American and Eastern societies.
Yeah.
There, I think, was a lot more affinity because so many people of German descent lived in the United States, and people from other parts of Europe who lived in the United States. So I don't think it was so remote, but we were at that time very inward looking. Again, it's something that you worry about today when you have political officials arguing that we need to withdraw from the world, that we shouldn't be as active internationally, that we shouldn't be an international policeman or shouldn't stand up for the downtrodden or the people who are victims of genocide today in places like Darfur or Rwanda. So it's a lesson that still needs to be learned, and that's one of the reasons I wrote 48 Hours of Kristallnacht, is I wanted to remind people of what happened and what can happen when good people allow evil to happen.
Yeah, yeah. And if our ears were not able to hear the cries in 1938, when we were talking about an America that had many people of German descent, it was Western societies, how much more difficult is it to hear it today, hear those cries today, when the threats are coming from societies and peoples that we feel less cultural compatibility with?
I think it also is a reminder, though, that some of those cultures have people who have very radical views towards us and mean us ill.
Yeah.
By no means all of them, and it's not necessarily a purely cultural or religious element of those societies, but there are people who mean us ill, and that we have to be prepared to understand that's their intent and to stand up against it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. It's just, I still think in light of all that's been published and written on matters of this sort since 2001, that many Americans don't feel that much more sensitized to the threat that's out there. It's a shame.
Well, I think we have short memories. I think already people have forgotten 9/11.
Yeah.
You heard at the time this was an unforgettable experience that would scar us forever, but I think many people have already forgotten.
Yeah.
And those threats still exist, and 48 Hours of Kristallnacht is designed to remind us of them.
Well, Mitchell, thanks so much. We'll have the book in the bookstore, and we'll recommend it.
Thanks very much. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Dr. Mitchell Baird, 48 Hours of Kristallnacht, Night of Destruction, Dawn of the Holocaust, an oral history. I'm Al Cresta.
The Ave Maria CD library continues to grow. On our Christ is the Answer program, Father John Ricardo is presenting a series of four talks on prayer. It's Lord, Teach Us to Pray. He addresses the practical steps, praying with Scripture, our Mother Mary, and much more. The four CD box set is $34. Just prior to the election, we featured Voting as a Catholic by Dr. Peter Kreft and The Truth About Stem Cell Research by Right to Life of Michigan's Ed Rivett. The election is passed, but these CDs should be in your library. All editions of Christ in the Afternoon, Catholic Connection, Christ is the Answer, Putting on the Mind of Christ, The Doctor is In, and Heart, Mind, and Strength are also available. All single talks and programs are on high-quality CDs and are $8.50 each. To place your order for one of these titles or to inquire about a talk topic of interest to you, call 734-930-4506. 734-930-4506. Or write orders at AveMariaRadio.net.
As Christians, we are called to commit all we have to Christ, our lives, our family, and our investments. Until I met Jim and Stacy at Faith Investment Services, I didn't realize the investments of most Christians end up supporting companies involved in the abortion, pornography, or same-sex lifestyle industry. As a pastor and a fellow Christian, I urge you to call Jim and Stacy today. They can screen your investments to see what you're currently supporting and then help redirect your investments with their morally guided investing. Let me make this clear. If your mutual funds, 401ks, and other investments have not been screened by Jim and Stacy, you can assume that right now they're supporting industries that are an abomination to Christians. The time to take a stand is today. For morally directed investment advice, call Jim and Stacy today at 1-800-529-9434, 1-800-529-9434, or visit morallydirected.com.
Securities offered through Next Financial Group Incorporated, member FINRA and SIPC. Faith Investment Services is not an affiliate of Next Financial Group Incorporated.
And good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. It's a pleasure to be with you. All of us want, we're meaning-seeking creatures, and one of the ways that we find meaning is by helping others. One of the ways that we understand who we are is how we're reflected back to by others. And my guest, Dr. Gregory Husko, has written Making a Difference by Being Yourself, Using Your Personality Type at Work and in Relationships. And Greg, nice to have you here.
Hey, my pleasure.
Yeah,
I look forward to it.
I'm glad you're nearby. It makes, I always like to be able to see people when we talk.
Yeah.
You've been teaching 31 years at Eastern Michigan University.
That's true.
And you love teaching.
I do.
You've taught at four universities. Where else have you taught?
I've taught at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. I teach at Southern Methodist University.
Yeah.
And I've also taught down at Southern Illinois University.
Yeah. Now, do students generally enter your classes understanding what they're going to do with their lives?
Well, I'm in the college business, so our students are a little more focused probably than some other majors and whatnot. But what they're going to do within the business world still is up in the air.
Yeah. Does it make a difference?
And they do respond to that theme, I find. More and more, this whole generation of students that are coming up are dedicated to these alternative spring breaks and Habitat for Humanity and other kinds of projects in the community.
Short-term mission trips in churches has become incredibly popular over the last 20 years, I've noticed.
Right.
Why? I mean, I'm not sure why that would be the case, though.
You know, I think making a difference, as you were suggesting earlier, is kind of a fundamental need. And that just going through the motions and just going through the step-by-step aspects of daily life is no longer fulfilling enough, I think.
Yeah.
And people want to help others, as well as, you know, it's one of those things that you can't lose. By helping others, you feel happier yourself as well. And I think it's also an alternative to perfectionism, you know, we're never going to be perfect, and yet does that mean we can do just anything and everything goes? No. It means trying to figure out what can I do that'll make a step forward, a step forward at work or a step forward in relationships. And so I think it's a healthy alternative to perfectionism, focusing in on the positive side of yourself without it being bragging or just for your own self-interest or whatever. So I think those combination of things has led to more and more people to look into this whole notion of what can I do to utilize aspects of myself that makes a difference and makes others feel good as well as myself.
Now, you use a four-part typology.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
We'll break those down for
okay.
me.
Okay. Well, and it's based basically on the framework of Carl Jung or of the Myers-Briggs type indicator.
Okay.
But I focus in on the middle two letters, if you're familiar with that code. But nonetheless, anyway, the four types are the stabilizers. Now, these are wonderful down-to-earth people. You know, they are just step-by-step, let's-just-get-it-done sort of people, very dependable types, very stable sort of types that make mm-hmm. a difference in work and in relationships by just kind of making things happen in a step-by-step sort of fashion and being there for people, even if that just means just sitting there as the person's talking and accepting them, not judging them, just being with them. Then the second type is the harmonizer type. These harmonizers are wonderful people that help people feel included. You know, some people that just, they don't have to memorize things about people. If you tell them something about yourself, it just sticks in their brain. They'll just remember that. And they're the kind people that remember to send cards and remember your birthday and help people, like I said, feel included in a group, will introduce people to other people.
Yes.
They'll make even impersonal tasks feel personal or feel genuinely personal, you know? And then the third type, the catalyst type, these are real spark plugs that believe in a cause and are inspirational in the way they express themselves about those causes. They think a little bigger picture, but really believe in people also in that we can do it together, you know, that let us all unite and move forward and make this cause that typically is also people-oriented successful.
Now, how does that person differ from your last category, which I think is visionary?
The last category is visionary. Yeah, and the visionary types want to put things together a bit more impersonally and make sure that there's a system there. They're fascinated by the interrelationship between possibilities,
okay.
and they want to kind of be the architects or the designers of the blueprints of the future.
But they frequently lack any cheerleader impulse.
Typically, yeah.
Yeah. I've noticed that.
God, you know those folks. Huh?
Yeah.
They're a little bit rarer in the U.S. population in particular, but they make a difference by helping us not just look at things one step at a time or one person at a time, but how can we fit this together to make a difference?
So stabilizers, harmonizers, catalysts, and visionaries.
Very good, yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. In a normal office setting,
mm-hmm.
How does that, you know, what positions are best suited for basic types?
Well, it's an interesting question, but I'd be very wary of hiring people based on personality.
Okay.
First and foremost, make sure they have the technical skills to be able to do the job sort of thing. Now, their personality type make them well-suited for certain kinds of roles to play. For instance, the stabilizer type, the task-oriented, step-by-step, let's get it done kind of folks, the harmonizer, the kind of natural team builder, kind of bringing people together. So if mm-hmm. you needed somebody in an office setting that's going to keep people involved, they may be a good one. The catalyst type may be a total turnaround of an organization. They're the kind of people, Al, that they couldn't just work for any organization. They'd have to believe in the cause of the organization. You know, it's not just a job. It's being part of an organization they can be proud of. And then the visionary types also kind of transformational changers, trying to think of, they think more long-term, more future-oriented, and more big-picture-oriented. So oftentimes, you know, they're the field marshals of change in organizations.
Are these people who, when we talk about these types,
uh-huh.
are we talking about, do these types function differently at work than they do at home or in friendships?
You know, that's a great question. Certainly, most of our behavior is based on the situation. I mean, we act differently in church than we would at a party.
Sure.
You know, but at the some part of you is there in both. And so these types, there may be subtle differences amongst these types in different situations, but situations drive a lot of our behaviors. But I did find through, as you may know, I interviewed 500 people, mm-hmm. and they each told me three stories each, and the themes were surprisingly similar for the themes for people at work and in relationships. And so it was kind of fun to see how they can use their basic personality type, whether it's with a loved one or whether it's at work, in a kind of fundamental, themal sort of way.
People know themselves well enough to identify?
Well, that's a good question, too. Some people have spent a lifetime trying to know themselves, and others kind of just glance through life and don't pay as much attention to it. I think it takes honesty. It takes self-reflection. It takes a willingness to take a look at yourself, not just criticize yourself, but look at yourself and know what your fundamentally are your natural preferences, something you're probably born with.
Does it change as you get older?
You know, we explore different sides of ourselves, I think, as we get older, that sense of completion. But I think a fundamental part of our personality follows us through life. But like I said, as we get older, the person that was a very outgoing extrovert in midlife may go to meditation and look at for that internal spiritual search, and that vice versa.
Sure.
An introvert that had spent much of their life inside themselves are now exploring the rest of the community and the rest of the folks around them.
Give me some, this may be dangerous to do, but, I can ask you anyways. Give me images from the world of celebrity or the world of entertainment, world of even history, historic, who might be types, personalities who exemplify these types.
Oh, boy, okay. Well, I think, let's start with the catalyst. I think people like... and notice how different these folks are. Martin Luther King, John F. Kennedy, Ronald Reagan. I would probably guess all three of those were the NF catalyst.
Catalyst, okay.
Yeah. Visionary types, probably more like the Al Gores, the folks kind of thinking big picture, but kind of coming up with that blueprint about what the future should look like.
Yeah. But in and of themselves have a difficult time motivating.
So, I mean, but, you know, they need to surround themselves with people that can...
Think of Dr. King versus Al Gore.
Yeah, right.
I mean, one guy's pretty stiff, the other guy is very warm.
You know? Right. And they both had a lot to offer, but, you know, you're right. Their style is so much different between the two of them. Yeah. Now, in terms of the harmonizer types, the real friendly types, you know, some of the characters from Friends that was on TV or whatever might be more the harmonizer types or you know, the natural cheerleaders of groups that bring people together. You know, those might be the kind of harmonizer type that brings a ball team together or brings acting unit together. The stabilizer types might be your basic John Wayne or your basic let's just do it sort of folks. Really kind of help us just think through that one step at a time.
You mentioned earlier that sometimes people go through their whole life wondering how they might identify themselves. What tools do you suggest people use to help clarify in this area?
Yeah. In fact, I include a few in the book itself, so there's several self-assessment instruments that people can use. And also, we've already mentioned the Myers-Briggs type indicator as the most used personality indicator in the United States, anyway, and probably worldwide.
It's been used for a long time.
It has been around
for
a while.
It's still being used.
And it's been improved, too, in terms of its reliability and validity.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, my publisher is offering a discount. There's a code that you can get by buying the book and utilizing it, and you can take that online as well and get a big feedback session. But another little fun exercise might be asking yourself the question, who am I? And writing down the phrase, and then asking yourself again the question, well, who am I? Not using the same phrase or the same word, what would you answer? And do that at least 10 times. And what I find, anyway, is that most people answer what they are rather than who they are.
Ooh, tell me more.
Well, like, I'm a teacher.
Oh, yes.
I'm a Catholic,
more functional.
I'm a Democrat, or I'm a... And while those are very fine answers and very true in terms of how the person identifies themselves, I think it's interesting to look at what's the who behind that what. You know, so if I declared myself to be a teacher, what am I saying about myself? You know, what would that say about my personality if I peel that down?
Yeah.
What am I proclaiming about myself? And what do I now understand a little bit more in terms of the core part of who I am? So those might be, you know, there are exercises, like I said, in the book, and there are instruments like the Myers-Briggs that can help people get a handle on that.
Do we often function at odds with who we are?
We have to. Situations drive behaviors.
Yeah.
But I tell you, if we have a lifetime where we always have to function at odds with ourselves, if we're in a job situation or in a relationship where it's not comfortable to be who we are, we're going to have a pretty stressful life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be very difficult for us to reach our potential. We can't be all things to all people.
Do particular types get along better with other types?
Well, that's interesting.
Dating,
too.
Marriage, mating, relating.
The good news is there's conflict in all kinds of relationships. And the good news is if you celebrate differences, there's wonderful things to be had no matter what the combination is. What we find are people of similar types will understand each other quicker. You know, and we'll be able to kind of pick up on those elements of what the other person's saying a lot faster. However, they also are after the same goodies, you know, and so they may compete with each other for airtime or for examples or for whatever anyway. And so of similar type, again, the instant connection, but they have to watch whether they're going to compete with each other. Of different types, it's going to take a little more to understand each other. And if we celebrate the differences between different people, you've got more to offer as a couple, as a team. You've got more of the blind sides of our personalities covered when people are different. So there's pros and cons both ends of that spectrum, but those are the kind of known patterns in terms of conflict and getting along.
Employers pay much attention to this?
Sometimes too much and sometimes not. Again, I find it inappropriate to use this to decide whether to hire people or not. But the Myers-Briggs in just the last year, over 2 million people took the Myers-Briggs type indicator in work settings to help people understand how to communicate more effectively with coworkers and with bosses and to be able to find a way to build better relations within the work setting.
Yeah. So it can help in terms of the chemistry, the corporate culture.
It sure can. And it shows respect. It means, you know, I tend to be more of the visionary type myself, and I've got to remember when talking with my students or other people in other settings to make sure I give examples, because I'm, like, fascinated with the framework.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I know what you mean.
And the research behind it, but I understand.
And if you have to get, you know full well, if you have to get to the particulars, you can do it. But why slow down the process of conception here?
Yeah. Right. But as long as I remind myself that I want to make a difference in that discussion there, I need to push myself to do that. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Husker,
for
being with me. A pleasure once again, knowing that you're nearby. I hope you can join us in the future.
I would love to.
Good. It's called Making a Difference by Being Yourself, Using Your Personality Type at Work and in Relationships. Dr. Gregory Husko, we have it available in the online bookstore. And get on over to AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Hi, this is Father John Ricardo, inviting you to join me as we explore some of the deepest questions that arise in our hearts, questions that shape the way we think, the way we speak, and the way we live. For all of these questions, Christ is the answer.
As part of his ongoing RCA for Catholic series, Father John continues a sub-series on prayer. Some of the attendees share the results of implementing what they learned at the last talk, and Father John teaches about Lectio Divina. Father Ricardo's title this week is Praying with Scripture. Listen to Christ is the Answer Wednesday evenings at 8, Saturday afternoons at 5, and Sunday mornings at 11 on 990 WDEL, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. He is the image of the invisible God. He points us to our destiny. He reveals the dignity of the human person. He is the one who makes known the Father. Christ is the Answer.
Christ is the Answer is brought to you by the Ave Maria Communications Guild.
Good day, I'm Al Cresta, and I've enjoyed broadcasting from the town of Ave Maria, home of Ave Maria University in southwest Florida. It's a unique community, organized around a beautifully designed oratory and Italian-style piazza. The town not only houses the university, but there's a Catholic elementary school, local businesses, a water park, world-class golf courses, a tennis club, and, of course, a wide range of homes available for purchase. The university is a source of concerts and lectures, art shows and student performances, a virtual cornucopia of Catholic culture, excellent for families or singles. But seeing is believing. I'd like you to take a virtual tour of the town by going to AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net. And imagine it as a home for your children or a haven for your retirement. Enjoy the sights at AveMariaRadio.net, and while there, register. There's absolutely no obligation, and you'll discover countless opportunities at the town of Ave Maria. Good afternoon. We've got two more hours coming up where you'll get a chance to talk about the things that matter most. The number is 1-877-573-7825. That's 1-877-573-7825. Now, head on over to AveMariaRadio.net. You can follow up on any of the conversations we've had thus far today. That, again, is AveMariaRadio.net. I'm looking here for the poll question, but I'm not able to find it, so I'm going to have to check my other notes in just a moment. But we'll have much to talk about. New information, first ovary transplant baby is with us. We'll be taking a look at, you know, now that the election's out of the way, we're going to go back. And there was one thing that I really, the whole William Ayers thing was a worthwhile issue. The problem is it was brought up in an exaggerated way, and therefore was discredited in the eyes of many. But I'm going to go back and talk with Ronald Radosh today. He knows the community out of which Ayers comes. And I don't think people understand. I recommend going back and watching that Weather Underground video that's somewhat sympathetic. And I don't think people remember. Now, I'm not... Having said that, do I have to say it again? Having said that, I'm not talking about Barack Obama, per se. I'm talking about William Ayers. And the question is, what are we doing with a fugitive like William Ayers hanging around in Chicago?
Would you like a copy of this program? If you miss a part of this program or want to hear it again, Ave Maria programming can be made yours when you order. Just call 734-930-4506. Within a few weeks, you'll receive a copy of this show and any others you want to order on CD. Call 734-930-4506.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. Each week we go into the Ave Maria CD library. We pull on a talk or two to see what our Lord might have to say to us. Most of these talks are recorded at area gatherings and conferences. Most of the speakers are nationally known. The topics are varied, but they are all centered on the Lord, and they all are worth your listening time. You're back from Mass. It's not yet dinner time. Why not sit back and join us? Be fed on the Lord. Listen this and every Sunday afternoon at 3 for Putting On the Mind of Christ on 990 WDEL in the Metro Detroit area and 1440 WMAX in the Saginaw Valley. Putting On the Mind of Christ is brought to you by the Ave Maria Communications Guild.
Looking for an exciting career? RH Publishing is currently launching 5 new local directories and is looking for sales leaders. If you are an experienced print media account executive, this sales position can be a perfect fit. This exciting opportunity, selling display ads in niche market yellow page directories, offers a base salary, plus rewarding commissions, benefits, and incentives throughout the year. A minimum of 1 year advertising sales experience is required. Territories include Wayne, Oakland, Macomb, Washtenaw, and Livingston County.